Picture this, a massive internal software launch at your company. The executive team is thrilled. Some vendor has just cashed a very large check, and the metaphorical confetti is just falling in the boardroom.
Right, everyone's celebrating.
Exactly. But then, Monday morning rolls around. The new system is crawling at a snail's pace. Nobody actually knows who holds the administrative rights to, approve the new
Oh,
workflows.
that's the worst.
Yeah. And the sales team has just quietly reverted to their old spreadsheets. So suddenly, this million-dollar initiative has paralyzed your core operations.
It is a scenario that plays out entirely too often. And I mean, the fallout goes far beyond just lost budget. It fractures trust across the entire organization.
It really does. Well, welcome to the deep dive. Whether you are prepping to lead a massive tech overhaul or you're just, endlessly curious about why so many corporate projects fail despite having immense funding, this deep dive is for you.
Absolutely.
Today, we are looking at a 2026 marketing checklist and practical guide. It's titled Website Conversion Audit for B2B Service Pages.
Which is a title that I think requires immediate clarification.
It does, right, because a website conversion audit sounds like, a purely marketing exercise. You hear that and you assume we're going to be discussing how tweaking button colors or rewriting landing page copy.
Oh, setting up A/B tests or something.
Exactly, to get higher sales. But when you dive into the actual material, this source is it's a masterclass in critical thinking.
Yeah, it really is.
It's a guide on how business leaders, specifically they mentioned targeting those in Orange County and Southern California, but really anyone, can evaluate risk, vendors, and budgets without falling for flashy sales pitches.
Right, because the transition from a simple marketing checklist to an enterprise risk framework, it makes total sense when you consider the architecture of modern business.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in 2026, a B2B website is not a digital brochure anymore. It's a highly complex node. It's directly integrated with a company's CRM, their payment gateways, proprietary databases.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that actually answers a major question I had while reading this. I was wondering why we are bringing the C-suite and IT security into what sounds like a marketing problem.
Exactly. Because if that conversion page is piping data directly into the core infrastructure, a broken form isn't just a lost lead anymore.
It's a potential API vulnerability.
Precisely. And the source emphasizes that technology decisions today are made under immense pressure. Budgets are tight, but more importantly, security expectations are uncompromising.
Right.
Modifying a B2B service page requires touching highly sensitive systems. If, say, a marketing plugin introduces a vulnerability that exposes user credentials or administrative access, I mean, the fallout is catastrophic.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So leadership is demanding hard evidence before they let any external recommendation touch their architecture.
Yes.
The guide also points out, which I found interesting, that the search for a website conversion audit usually only happens when a team already feels a painful gap. Like they aren't just browsing for optimization ideas on a quiet Friday afternoon.
No, not at all. The search is entirely reactive. That operational gap usually feels highly stressful.
Right.
A company might be experiencing weak documentation or agonizingly slow system response times, or just a complete lack of visibility into daily operations.
Or sometimes they realize their relationship with a current vendor is built entirely on just trust and not enough on actual process.
Exactly.
It sounds to me like searching for a conversion audit is like finally going to the dentist because your tooth is killing you, rather than going for a routine cleaning.
That is a perfect analogy. Yes, you're only in that chair because the pain has reached the nerve.
But let me push back a little here. Are buyers just being overly paranoid in 2026? Or is the risk actually higher?
No, the risk actually is higher because the systems are so interconnected now. And that pain you mentioned, it makes executives vulnerable to terrible decisions.
Oh, interesting.
When a company is feeling that kind of operational agony, the immediate reflex is to buy a shiny new software tool to, mask the symptom.
Ah, the tool-first mentality. Like you have a reporting problem, so you just buy a new dashboard tool.
Yeah, completely ignoring the fact that your underlying data taxonomy is a total mess.
Right, yeah.
So the core goal has to be translating that vague feeling of a gap into clear, process-driven decisions. Decisions that finance, technical, and executive leaders can all actually agree on.
So, how does the guide suggest doing that?
Well, the guide is explicitly structured as an antidote to that tool-first reflex. It advises leadership to slam on the brakes, basically, to slow the decision-making process down just enough to ask better questions.
Otherwise, you end up with a project that looked great in a sales pitch, but is a nightmare to operate later.
Exactly. The rule is you have to start with the outcome. You define the business process to improve, the risk you want to reduce, and the metric that will prove progress, all before you even look at integrations or vendors.
But wait, how do you actually force a panicked executive team to slow down? I mean, when the business is screaming for an immediate fix, if you tell a stressed C-suite to slow down, they'll just bypass you.
Yeah, they absolutely will. Which is why The Source provides this protocol called the Practical Next Step.
Okay, what's that?
It gives the executive team a deliverable. You know, it satisfies that urge for action without committing to a massive software contract.
Oh, that's smart. How does it work on the ground?
You simply document the current state and you choose the single most important outcome. So instead of a vague mandate like, we need a new CRM, you create a short action plan, assigning ownership, timing, and a first measurable checkpoint.
So it isolates the wound and defines the boundaries of the fix before you ever speak to a vendor.
Exactly. You establish the business logic first.
Okay, so once you have that, The Source repeatedly hammers home these four golden questions that you have to ask vendors.
Yes, these are non-negotiable filters.
Right. So question one, what evidence supports the recommendation? But honestly, every vendor has a polished, cherry-picked case study ready to go, right? So how does the guide define actual evidence?
Yeah, a marketing case study is just a narrative. The evidence this source demands is diagnostic proof.
Diagnostic proof.
Right. Proof that the vendor's specific fix addresses your specific documented gap. So if they say their tool increases conversions by 30%, the evidence required is a technical explanation of how it will integrate with your messy database without breaking your current API calls.
Oh, wow. So it forces the vendor to solve your reality, not their, you know, hypothetical scenario.
Exactly.
It's great. Okay. Question two. Who owns the outcome after launch? I feel like this is the exact point where most corporate projects quietly fail.
Oh, 100%.
Everyone is eager to cut the ribbon on launch day, but nobody wants to be responsible for, like, the workflows 6 months later.
Accountability naturally diffuses after launch. So this question forces the organization to assign a name to the maintenance phase before you even finish planning.
Smart. Then question three. What risks should be handled before implementation?
Right. This turns the lens inward. It forces a company to clean its own house.
Yeah, because bringing a sophisticated new vendor into an environment with undocumented legacy code or fractured data silos, I mean, that guarantees failure.
Exactly. The vendor can't fix your internal disorganization.
Which perfectly sets up the fourth question. How will success be measured after 30, 60, and 90 days?
Yes. You have to set those measurement windows prior to signing a contract. It prevents subjective analysis later. If they can't provide a mathematical definition of success at day 30, the initiative is just too vague.
Okay, so once you've filtered your options with those questions, the guide introduces a 2026 vendor scorecard.
Right.
And a strong scorecard has to score vendors based on evidence, not promises. The criteria include capability, security, communication, cost transparency, and exit readiness.
Yes, and they suggest asking for actual workflow diagrams and realistic timelines before approving any work.
The guide also flags some common warning signs, right? Like vague scopes of work, missing ownership, pricing that hides ongoing maintenance, and no rollback plan.
Right. If a vendor cannot clearly explain the first 90 days, the project isn't ready. Period.
I want to focus on exit readiness for a second. Out of all the criteria, that one is the most compelling to me. It sounds incredibly pessimistic, like, you know, like asking for a divorce settlement on a first date.
I mean, I get that. It's a striking visual. But for the listener, it's really important to recontextualize this. It's not pessimism. It's operational discipline.
Really? How so?
Because avoiding vendor lock-in is a foundational security requirement. Requesting code ownership, data export options, and a transition process early on that is the clearest signal of a mature, disciplined partner.
Okay, so a vendor confident in their value shouldn't be threatened by a client wanting to control their own data.
Exactly. You demand documentation, access control records, and clear administrative handoff steps before the project even starts.
Got it. Okay, but let's assume the external process is flawless. You find a vendor with great exit readiness. They answer the golden questions. The contract is airtight. The source warns that the project can still just die from within.
Yes. The external vendor might execute perfectly, but if the internal team isn't structured to receive it, it'll fail.
Right. So we transition to the sources framework for internal accountability, the internal ownership model. It requires four distinct roles.
Right.
And it notes that in small companies, these can overlap, but the responsibilities themselves have to remain visible. You have the executive sponsor, the business owner, the technical owner, and the operational reviewer.
Without this ownership, yeah. A good recommendation literally dies after the first meeting.
I was trying to map these roles in my head to make them more memorable, and it operates very much like a restaurant kitchen.
Oh, I like that. Let's hear it.
Okay, so the executive sponsor is the restaurant owner. They fund it. They remove blockers. The business owner is the head chef. They design the menu, define the outcomes.
Okay.
The technical owner is the kitchen mechanic. They ensure the ovens actually work and the gas lines are safe. And finally, the operational reviewer is the line cook. The person who actually has to chop the onions every single day and confirm the day-to-day fit.
That is a fantastic analogy.
Yeah.
And building on that, keeping in mind the source's point about the deep security and compliance dimensions of 2026, mm-hmm. Protecting credentials, customer info, analytics access.
Right.
That makes the mechanic and line cook roles absolutely vital for everyday protection. If the chef writes a brilliant menu, but the ovens leak gas, the restaurant burns down.
Exactly. And if the new knife the chef bought is too heavy, the line cook will just bring their own from home, right?
Exactly. They just bypass the system. Which brings us to the armor that protects all four of these roles.
Yeah.
Documentation.
Yes. Documentation. Everyone praises it, but nobody wants to do it.
Right. But it is critical. It cannot be postponed to the end. It includes decision notes, architecture diagrams, escalation contacts.
Because that documentation protects the company, right? Like if a key employee, say, your brilliant technical owner leaves or a system fails.
Or a future team 2 years from now needs to know why a specific decision was made. Documentation is the only institutional memory you have.
Okay, so we have the plan, the vendor, the internal kitchen staff, and the documentation. Now, how does this actually hit the ground without blowing up?
This is where the 90-day execution engine comes in. It prevents the rollout from becoming an open-ended disaster.
The guide breaks this down into three phases. Days 1 through 30, clarify the current state and priority gaps.
Right. No building in the first month.
Then days 31 through 60, implement and pilot the highest value improvement.
Keep it small.
And days 61 through 90, review results, document lessons, and adjust. But the source insists that the progress metrics, things like downtime reduction, conversion rate, security findings resolved, they must be chosen before implementation starts.
Yes, this is crucial. If you don't choose them beforehand, human nature kicks in, and the team will just invent a success narrative after the fact based on whatever metric happened to go up.
Oh, we missed our conversion goals, but page views are up. So the guide also lists common rollout mistakes. Rushing from approval to implementation without checking dependencies, underestimating training, skipping user acceptance testing, over-customizing before validating the core process.
All very common.
But there's one major mistake listed that I have to push back on.
Okay, what is it?
The source explicitly states that it is a major error to leave old workflows running beside the new ones. But wait, leaving old workflows running seems like a safe backup plan. Why is the source calling that a mistake?
It's a common protective instinct, but running parallel systems fundamentally undermines the rollout. It splinters user adoption.
Splinters adoption? How?
Because if you leave the old familiar workflow available, people will secretly continue using it to avoid the friction of learning a new interface.
Oh, I see.
Which creates dirty data. Half your team is in the new CRM, half is in a local Excel file.
Right, so automated calls fail, access logs are fragmented.
Exactly. Furthermore, running parallel systems prevents you from ever truly testing if the new implementation actually works under a full load. A disciplined rollout keeps the first phase small, but it ruthlessly forces adoption. You have to sever the old line.
So you can't have half the kitchen cooking the old menu and half cooking the new one.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense. Now, for businesses in SoCal, the source highlights the role of technical consultancies like Technigian. They offer focused consultations, review current environments, and build these phased roadmaps for Orange County businesses so leaders don't have to guess at dependencies.
Right. And it also recommends cross-referencing broader guidance from places like nngroup.com and developers.google.com for broader context.
To ensure you're aligning with industry standards.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we have covered a tremendous amount of ground today. Let me synthesize this for you, the listener. If there is a primary takeaway here, it's that a website conversion audit isn't just a one-time technical task. It is a comprehensive business strategy connecting impact, security, cost, and ongoing support.
It really is a phenomenal framework.
I agree. Do you have any final thoughts on this?
I do, actually. I want to leave the listener with a final provocative thought to mull over, building on the source's themes of gaps and internal ownership.
Okay, let's hear it.
The source tells us to document gaps and define success metrics before we start. But think about this. What if the true value of a conversion audit isn't actually in the new software or the vendor it recommends?
Wait, then where is the value?
What if the ultimate value is that the audit forces your organization to finally confront its own internal dysfunctions and lack of accountability?
Wow. So the audit is like a diagnostic mirror for the whole operational structure. You start out hoping to optimize a website, and you end up restructuring how your executive team communicates and manages risk.
Exactly. It might be the healthiest thing to happen to your architecture.
That is a fantastic point to end on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take this 2026 checklist into your next big meeting, demand the evidence, prioritize your exit readiness, and we will catch you next time.